Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Broadcast. This is Kevin Swanson, your host today, as we come back to the subject of taking godly dominion over God's creation. In fact, this is a major theme in our K-12 curriculum for science. We've completed first grade, fourth grade, fifth, and sixth grade science, and one of the most important elements, of course, is to give God the glory for his amazing creation. That's on every page of the science courses, but also we have an obligation to take proper biblical dominion over God's creation. We've been given that at the creation mandate, and we continue that as faithful followers of Jesus. And so today we're going to bring E. Calvin Beisner back on our program. And he's been working in this field for a very long time. And now, of course, we're beginning to see environmentalism take a front seat position in the Biden agenda. And this, and if you don't get Calvin Beisner's updates from Cornwall Alliance, you need to sign up for this, friends. I get them on a daily basis or maybe a couple times a week basis and encourage you to that. But as Mark Mills points out in Mines, Minerals, and Green Energy, the energy equivalent of 100 barrels of oil is used to fabricate a single electric car battery that stores the energy equivalent of one barrel of oil. Now, this is from the update. The average barrel of oil yields 19.36 gallons of gas. The average gas-powered car on America's roads gets 24.9 miles per gallon. So the barrel of oil yields enough gas for 482 miles. And 100 barrels of oil, the amount needed to fabricate an electric car battery that goes into the electric car would yield 48,210 miles. All right, so just out of curiosity, I wanted to compare that to a gas-run vehicle. And so the electric car requires 30,000 pounds of oil to build a car battery for one electric car. Add to that 30,000 pounds of coal to take an electric car, to power an electric car for 100,000 miles, and that adds up to roughly 120,000 pounds of carbon dioxide to take an electric car 100,000 miles. So then I compared that to a gas car. It takes 3,000 gallons of gas to go 100,000 miles, which is about 18,000 pounds of gas to go the 100,000 miles. That amounts to about 54,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. So an electric car produces 120,000 pounds of carbon dioxide to make the car battery and for the coal required to power the electric car over 100,000 miles. So the electric car produces 120,000 pounds of carbon dioxide over 100,000 miles. A gas car produces 54,000 pounds of carbon dioxide over 100,000 miles. According to my calculation, the electric car produces twice the carbon dioxide of a gas car. But that's okay because carbon dioxide is good for plants. But is it melting the icebergs in the Arctic and bringing about a global disaster? All right, so that's the... If your mind isn't blown at this point, Calvin Beisner is going to clarify these things for us today on this edition of the program. Cal, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you back with us.
Kevin, it's great to be back, and I really enjoyed your introduction there. The fact is that it's really difficult to get much clarity on this stuff because the accounting in terms of what goes into creating an EV battery, what goes into generating all the electricity for it, there are many variables. Mm. But the sort of the takeaway is that you need a whole lot more resources, a whole lot more stuff taken out of the earth to drive an electric vehicle 100 miles than to drive a gas or diesel vehicle 100 miles. Mm. And so if what we're thinking about is trying to conserve resources, well, that's not the best way to go about it. Mm. And then besides that, there is no clear indication that running the EV vehicle is going to put less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than running the gas or diesel-powered vehicle. So if you want to try to fight global warming driven by carbon dioxide emissions, you probably are not going to have any success there either. Mm-hmm. But then, as you mentioned, when we add CO2 to the atmosphere, plants grow better, and that makes more food for everything that eats plants or eats something that eats plants. And that's really good for, you know, all animal life on the earth and all plant life on the earth. And the ones who benefit the most are the poor, because it drives down food prices.
Calvin, it just seems to me that we're confused. The modern environmentalism that is so dominant in our schools, universities, the political establishment, this is just confusing. Are we getting the maximum good, or are we in some way compromising science? Is that your concern, that we're compromising real science?
Oh, yeah, there's a great deal of that going on. In fact, we're practically redefining what science means. The alarmists about climate change will constantly reply, follow the science. Or if you question the reality of dangerous man-made global warming through emissions of CO2, you are a science denier. But the reality is that the real science deniers are on the other side. They're on the alarmist side. Here's why I say that. The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman, back in the 1950s, wrote in a very fine book on physics, and then later many times in lectures, he discussed what he came to call the key to science. Your listeners can just Google for Richard Feynman, that's F-E-Y-N-M-A-N, the key to science, and watch a video from clear back in 1964 when he was lecturing, where he explains how we go about discovering a new natural law or a new way that some natural system functions. And he says, here's how we do it. First, we guess. And then we make predictions of what we should observe in the real world if our guess is correct. Then we compare our observations in the real world, whether it's out in nature or in a laboratory where we're doing experiments, with those predictions. If the observations contradict the predictions, then the theory, the guess, is wrong. And it doesn't matter how smart you are or how beautiful your guess is or anything else. If the observations contradict the predictions, your guess is wrong. And then, like every good scientist, you go back to the drawing table and you revise your guess, or you toss it out completely and look for a new guess, and you do the whole process over again. Now, if your predictions match the observations, your guess might be right. But we never know for sure that that's the case in empirical science because of what is called the inductive fallacy. If you've guessed that all swans are white, what if, 10 years from now you come across a black swan? Then you have to revise your guess. So in empirical work, we never say the science is settled.
Yeah.
Instead, what we say is, well, so far what we've observed is consistent with my guess, but I can't know for sure if the guess is true. But if any observations have contradicted the guess, then I know the guess was wrong. Well, here's what's happening in alarmist climate science. They are using computer models of how the climate system works to make predictions about how much warming should come from adding CO2 to the atmosphere. And to make a long and very complex story short, here's what we find. When we compare those predictions with observations in the real world, we find that the predicted warming is 2 to 4 times as much as actually observed over the relevant period. That means that the guess, the theory, the hypothesis that is represented in the models is wrong, and it's time to go back to the drawing board. But instead, the climate alarmists simply say, oh, if you disagree with the models, you are a science denier. No, they're the real science deniers.
Is it proper to compare computer modeling to alchemy and astrology and other forms of pseudoscience that came with the humanist renaissance in the 1400s? I mean, there was some progress made in science in the 1300s and 1400s. You get the humanist renaissance, alchemy and astrology, and predictions on the basis of astrology became important to so many, especially in Italy. But do you see that maybe this predictive modeling has some comparison to astrology and the predictions that came from the presumptive, you know, causal influences of the stars?
Well, it's a whole lot more sophisticated what's going on now. I mean, after all, they didn't need the world's biggest, fastest supercomputers to run the millions and millions of lines of code that go into a typical computer climate model. But sophistication and accuracy or rightness are never to be confused. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that these climate models simply are almost worse than guesswork, actually.
Okay.
They're trying to model a system, the climate system, that is probably the most complex natural system we have ever studied, with the possible exceptions of DNA and the human brain. There are literally thousands of factors in this climate system. And for most of them, we do not know their magnitude. We do not know how much influence they have on whatever outcome it is that we're looking for, whether it's global average temperature or some regional temperature or windiness or rainfall or drought or storminess or anything else. For the vast majority of the components, we don't know their magnitude. We don't know how strong they are. And for a pretty significant number of the components, we don't even know whether their influence is positive or negative. That is, we don't know whether if you impose a certain influence from outside the system onto the system, these components will magnify or reduce the influence of that external factor. Mm-hmm. And yet, the climate modelers fill in the magnitude and, in some instances, the sign, the positive or negative, of all of these different factors. Mm-hmm. And then they run their models. And then they claim that because they are able to make their models retrodict, that is, predict backward, okay, so that they get a reasonably close match to past temperatures, therefore the models can be trusted for prediction. And that is absolutely unscientific, because every engineer who has ever tried to model anything can tell you, if you already know the results you need to get, you can get those results from any model by simply plugging in the right parameters, the right arbitrary numbers into the right places. But you don't know if it's actually those parameters that caused the outcome in the past, because it might have been other parameters that caused that outcome in the past, and you just happened to find some that might have worked if they had been around, but you don't know if they were around. So the only way you can really know that a model is correct in how it represents some natural system is by comparing its predictions of the future before the future happens with the actual outcome as the future happens. And when we do that, the models fail miserably.
In other words, predicting the past in terms of the movement of the stars is much easier than predicting the future of the movement of the stars, applying the astrology example to the modern computer modeling thing.
Yeah, though actually predicting the future positions of stars is pretty simple, and astronomers had learned how to do that with an awful lot of stars and planets, actually clear back more than 2,000 years ago. That was fairly simple stuff to do. But if in your astrology, you're trying to predict the behavior of human beings who have minds, who are able to make choices, who respond differently from one person to another to different circumstances, then all the modeling you can conceivably do of where the stars are going to be is not going to tell you anything about what those people are going to do, what they're going to think, what they're going to feel, how they are going to affect each other. Well, this computer modeling of the climate system is perhaps a little bit more like that than the modeling of the position of the stars.
Right. Gotcha. Let's talk about the Biden agenda. I know things have changed somewhat since the Biden administration has taken over. And what is the National Climate Emergency Act? And I think you called it a suicide pill in one of your updates. Clarify for us.
Yeah, well, it was introduced into the Congress in February, and thus far, I'm pleased to say, it has made practically zero progress. It's been assigned to a couple of committees or subcommittees and, you know, not seriously dealt with in them yet. I think that's not terribly surprising because Congress tends to be cowardly when it comes to taking clear positions that are going to cost vast amounts of money to the populace, unless that spending is directly favorable to lots of people. It has a lot of specific recipients who say, oh, gee, I'm sure glad I got that stimulus check, whatever it might be, right? Mm-hmm. The climate agenda is, in one sense, popular in that vast numbers of Americans believe in dangerous man-made global warming. But it's not particularly popular when you ask people, okay, how much would you be willing to spend per year to reduce future temperature? And the answer to that tends to run around about 10 bucks per person per year or less. Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely not even in the same universe with what the National Climate Emergency Act or the Green New Deal or the Paris Climate Agreement would have us spending. But fundamentally, the Climate Emergency Act would bring us into spending vast amounts of money to do all kinds of large-scale mitigation and resiliency projects. That's one way of looking at it. Upgrading public infrastructure to expand access to clean and affordable energy, transportation, high-speed broadband, and water. It's a true mystery to me how they got high-speed broadband into there. What that has to do with fighting climate change, I don't know. But we can back up to expanding access to clean and affordable energy. Now, what they mean by clean energy in this is very clearly wind, solar, and other so-called renewables. But as Mark Mills, an energy expert, points out in a wonderful essay called Mines, Minerals, Green Energy Reality Check, which the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation is offering free as our way of saying thanks when people make a donation of literally any size during this month. And they can do that at cornwallalliance.org and just ask for it. Mines, minerals, and green energy. Mills points out that as a matter of fact, generating energy from wind and solar is not cleaner than generating energy from coal, oil, or natural gas. It's dirtier, partly because you need to use an enormous amount of coal or oil or natural gas to make the machines that that produce that energy from wind and solar, but partly too because to make those machines, you have to mine thousands of times as much stuff out of the earth to make wind turbines that would generate the same amount of electricity as, say, a 1 gigawatt natural gas-fired electric generating plant. And not only do you have to pull all that stuff out of the earth, but also you're going to have to cover an area that is nearly 1,000 times as large with wind turbines as the small area that you would if you generate that energy from natural gas. So,
wow.
This Climate Emergency Act is I think probably never going to get through Congress, but Biden is attempting to push through a lot of its basic ideas by means of executive orders and agency decrees from, say, the EPA or the Department of Energy, et cetera.
As I hear you talk, I think to myself that this isn't just an economic problem. There are so much counterproductive effects that happen when people swallow this environmental religion. There's got to be something more fundamental. Obviously, you know, science is being undermined, but is there something else that concerns you about this modern environmental movement that has such a suicidal and a counterproductive element to it?
Oh, absolutely. And it is what has led me to dedicate the last 15 years of my professional life to what we do with the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, which is to educate the public and policymakers on biblical earth stewardship and economic development for the poor, as well as the gospel of Christ. The policies called for by those who demand that we make a rapid shift from fossil fuels, which currently provide roughly 85% of all the energy that human beings use in the world, to wind and solar, which currently provide between 2-3% total of all the energy that we use in the world.
Right.
Those policies would drive up the price of energy for everybody. And the ones most harmed by that would be the world's poor. In the United States, for example, the average middle-income family spends about 7-8% of its income on energy alone, just energy. That's electricity. It might be natural gas for heating the home. It's going to be gas for the car, but energy. The average poor family in the United States spends well over 40% of its income just on energy.
Wow.
So suppose that you double the price of energy, and that's not at all a stretch when it comes to what's happened. I mean, Germany has already seen its electricity prices far more than double since it began what it calls its Energiewende, its new energy path. And suppose that you do that. Well, for the average American family, well, that means it's going to go up from about 7-8% of the income to about 14-16%. It hurts. It's, you know, it stings a bit, but it's survivable. If you're the average poor family and you're already spending about 40% of your income just on energy, and the price of energy doubles, guess what? You're now spending 80% of your income just on energy. How about housing, clothing, food, shelter, medical care? This is dreadfully hard on the poor. And that's why I think it is so important that we interfere with this, not only to protect the poor, but also to protect the environment for a very simple reason. A clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good. And, you know, just as with, say, BMWs and Mercedes-Benz, wealthy people can afford more than poor people can. And so if you want to find the dirtiest parts of a city, you go to the poor neighborhoods, not to the wealthy. If you want a clean, healthful, beautiful environment, you need to want people to be prosperous. But this kind of policy harms the poor. It also slows economic development. And it's economic development is going to lift the remaining poor of the world out of poverty. India, for example, has over 300 million people with zero access to electricity right now. That's almost as many people as in the entire United States population. Those people desperately need the energy that they would get from coal, oil, and natural gas, and that would be much cleaner for them than the energy that they now get primarily from wood and dried dung.
And don't forget that the Social Security program is going downhill. They're looking at about a 30 to 40% cut in the check by 2034. And that's 80 million baby boomers, 75% of which are retiring with no savings. So, you know, you add all that together, and I think you're going to see a massive impact upon the poor if some of these policies are put into play. Let me just close with this, Cal. I guess there are a lot of Christians, about half Christians, according to recent surveys, support Biden's environmental policies. Only 28% of evangelicals, but a lot of Christians do support these environmental policies and the pseudoscience of modern environmentalism. I guess my question is, shall we speak of these things in the churches? I'm guessing a lot of pastors are saying, oh, it's controversial. We don't want these questionable and quarrelsome issues introduced into the church. How would you respond to that?
Well, the Apostle Paul said in Galatians 2:10 that when he had visited the other apostles in Jerusalem, the only thing they asked of him was that he should remember the poor. Mm-hmm. And he said, the very thing that I was already intent on doing. You know, the destructiveness of this kind of policy to the poor should make it a, if not a first item on the agenda, it should be very near the top of the agenda of pastors and churches all over this country to address this problem, because we are going to see poverty increase because of policies like this. Yeah. And poverty hurts. It shortens people's lives. It leads to more illness and so on. Now, pastors need to actually learn about this. It is not, it's not elementary stuff. This is difficult stuff to learn about. And that's why the Cornwall Alliance is dedicated to, you know, to providing really excellent information from our network of almost 70 different scholars, about a third natural scientists, including, by the way, some of the world's top climate scientists, and about a third economists, especially economists of environment and development, and the other third, roughly, theologians, philosophers, pastors, and so on. So I would just invite those pastors who are wondering about this to come to cornwallalliance.org, subscribe to our free email newsletter, read many of our literally hundreds and hundreds of articles and a number of major studies on our website, follow our Facebook page, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, and view some of our videos, including, I think especially for that kind of education, our weekly live stream where we discuss issues like this with top experts. That's available both on our Facebook page and on our YouTube channel, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation.
Yes, weekly live stream just added recently. I recommend that resource to you as well, my friends. E. Calvin Beisner has been our guest today on the Generations broadcast. Again, the website is cornwallalliance.org, and would recommend that you sign up for the weekly newsletter. That's cornwallalliance.org. Cal, thanks so much. Appreciate you coming back on the Generations broadcast.
You're welcome, Kevin, and thanks very much to you. God bless.
This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.